I'm Rebecca Bissonette, and I'm chairing this session. It'll be a panel discussion on whys and hows of developing and sustaining a successful consortium. I'm not part of a consortial project, but I am part of a partnership between Ford Motor Company and the Benson Ford Research Center at the Henry Ford. So there's, even if you're not part of a consortium, there's like different partnerships that you could look at. And maybe if you don't end up going out and joining a consortium or starting one, you can look at ways you can forge different partnerships based on the information we'll provide here today. So we're going to look at developing and sustaining successful consortia. And the panelists today are going to share models for EAD networks as well as regional affiliations and discuss the rationales for participation, their experiences with collaborations, some of the infrastructure, institutional roles, administration and planning, and then the life cycle and issues of sustainability. So I'm going to introduce all of our speakers, and they'll give a very brief presentation on their projects and outcomes, and then we'll have hopefully a lot of time for questions and discussion as well. So our first speaker is Jody Allison Bunnell. Hope I got that right. And she is the program manager for Northwest Digital Archives, which is a consortium. Can everybody still hear me okay? A consortium for founded in 2002 that offers access to finding aids from institutions in Washington, Oregon, Alaska, Idaho, and Montana. Prior to her work at NWDA, she was the archivist at University of Montana, Missoula. She holds an MLS and an MA from the University of Maryland at College Park. And our second panelist is Jennifer Betts. And Jennifer is project manager of Rhode Island Archival and Manuscript Collections Online, or RIAMCO, an EAD consortium. She's worked at Brown University as assistant EAD librarian and manuscripts librarian, Brown Family Papers. She previously worked at Albany Institute of History and Art and the New York State Archives Partnership Trust. She earned a master's degree in library science from the University of Albany. And then our third speaker is Christine DiBella, and she's the archivist for the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. Prior to assuming her current position, she was the archivist and project director for the Philadelphia Area Library Consortium of Special Collections Libraries, or PACSCL. And specifically the Consortial Survey Initiative, a project to assess un- and underprocessed archival collections at 22 area institutions. She's also held positions at the 92nd Street Y, the Bentley Historical Library, and the University of Michigan, and Harvard Business School. She received her MSI from University of Michigan School of Information and a bachelor's degree from Wesleyan University. And she's the current chair of the Delaware Valley Archivists Group. And also joining us as a special guest star today is Kat Euler. And Kat is a project archivist for Arizona Archives Online, where she can devote her entire time to consortia work. She's a recent graduate of University of Michigan, where she first learned about and advocated for EAD. So thanks for joining us again, and we'll get started.
Thank you, Rebecca. So I'm going to start with a very brief introduction to Northwest Digital Archives. Many of you may have heard of the program before. So this is an old quote at this point, and Linda Long is probably a little tired of me using it, but I keep using it because it's still a good quote. This still captures the essence of what we do, is being able to offer researchers access to collections that they wouldn't otherwise have, down at the component level, beyond the MARC record, to a level of detail that's otherwise unavailable, and with a mix of institutions that you otherwise don't find with other tools. So, we're a regional consortium. We provide enhanced access to archives and manuscript collections. We're now at about 5,100 finding aids. We began building this in 2002. And again, we bring together a unique mix of different types of institutions. as an EAD consortium, the main way that I describe our work is that we provide very efficient collection exposure. That, and you as archivists all understand how efficient the finding aid is at providing very broad collection exposure, very different from the item-level digitization project, which is valuable for other reasons, but doesn't offer such broad exposure. We've been able to standardize in the region levels of archival description to an extent that we were not able to before. And we provide links to digitized content where it's available. A really brief tour of what the website looks like. And this, looking at the website, is actually not how most of our researchers come in. 90% of our traffic is from search engines and referring sites like library catalogs and Wikipedia. So most people actually come in and drop into the site and directly into a finding aid from a search engine search. But for archivists, I'll start with the actual site. So this is the home page, your standard keyword search box. We have searching options beyond the front page, offering a number of ways to enter the site for more expert searches or for those who have come directly to the site because they know that. There's also an advanced search. You can combine different types of terms. Again, this is mostly for reference use and for expert users who are familiar with the site, with finding aids, all of those kinds of things. Offers you a number of ways to get into things. This is what our database usage looks like. So we had 24 finding aids retrieved in January 2006, some of the earliest statistics that we have. In April, we were up to over 27,000. Over that time, we average about 13,000 a month. Over the last year, that average is more between 20 and 22,000 finding aids a month. So we have seen steady increases. We get all kinds of funny spikes and lows with the swing of the academic year. That's clearly one of our big user groups. And again, most people come through other sites. Only 10% of the traffic comes directly through our own site. And one of the things that I like to test as program manager is when people are doing a Google search, is that both turning up finding aids at the collection level and is it reaching down to the component level? And I find consistently that it does get to the component level. I have various item level searches that I like to do just to see where they show up in Google results. And the results are quite high. We use Google sitemaps to facilitate that. Here are top documents retrieved over the last year. This is my fiscal year 9 statistics. Our consistent bestseller is the Montana State Prison Records from the Montana Historical Society. That's a finding aid that has a huge number of personal names in it. Again, we find personal names and organization names are our main entry points, our most popular keywords. But we'll also notice that there's a consistent and very peculiar interest in the Expo 74 World's Fair Records, which was held in Spokane, Washington. There are a number of Expo 74 fan sites that link directly to that finding aid that account for a lot of that traffic. You never know what people are going to be interested in. So again, this shows the mix of historical societies and academic institutions that get a lot of exposure through this site. Here's where people are from who tend to use our collections. Not surprising that Seattle and Portland as the two largest metropolitan areas in the Northwest would be consistent ones. Missoula, where I actually live, there's a lot of reference use there from the University of Montana, Spokane and Eugene, also you know medium-sized cities, so a lot of traffic from there. Our top countries, we see consistently used from about 90 countries all around the world. Even though it's not in the top five, we see consistent high usage from Scandinavian countries because of a collection of oral histories at Pacific Lutheran University. Here's our membership. Sorry the type's so small, but that's the only way I can fit all 28 of them on there. And here's an idea of what our consortium members get. When we made our transition from grant funding to sustainable funding, which I'll talk about in a moment, one of the things that I made up for our membership was what was called and which I still refer to as the give and get list. Because this is one of the main questions that you have to confront in a consortium is why should I be a member of this? Why should I give whatever I'm going to give? What am I going to get in return? this is the basic list of what our members are getting. The collection exposure, the connections to colleagues, many of our members develop relationships, mentor and otherwise, with one another. Technical infrastructure. None of our institutions have to run an EAD site. They don't have to write style sheets. They don't have to correct things. That's taken care of by our database administration. The administration, communications, going after and administering grants, dissemination and marketing, that's all taken care of in my half-time position, along with all that new member recruitment. Training and support, best practices, individual consultations with institutions is also another thing that I support. Here's briefly where we came from, starting with grant funding in 2002, continuing with further grant funding 2005 through 2007. Part of that last period was actively working on the question of sustainability. We became a program of the Orbis Cascade Alliance in 2007. Unlike many other projects that are confined to a single state, we couldn't find an institution that was going to take on the program and pay for it. We had to find some way to have an administrative and technical home, but to pay for that. So our members pay fees, which this year range from about $1,500 to $6,000 per institution, depending on institution size. Very interesting process to figure out a cost distribution strategy. And if you go and ask, well, what does everybody else do? They usually come and ask back and ask you, well, we were hoping that you would figure that out. In these tough economic times, it's actually a great time not to be centrally funded. Our budget is made of lots of little pieces. So this is where we are in summer of 2009 with 28 members, the 5,100 finding aids, and continued program viability. We'll continue to develop our EAD program with more collection exposure. Tools development, you know, EAD is still hard. It's still time-consuming. We are constantly seeking ways to make EAD more part of the workflow, make it easier for our members to do. And then we have cross-search capabilities, things like contributions to Archive Grid and exploring work with other consortia. The other thing that we've spent a lot of time on in the last 2 years is our digital program development. EAD finding aids being all very nice, but while also wanting connections to digital collections. There's been a whole needs assessment, which I will cover very, very quickly, of four parts, finding out what was already going on, key researcher groups, directly interviewing researchers to find out their needs and research modes, and then surveying our institutions for what exactly types of infrastructure we were looking for. And really my theme song is our collections are special, infrastructure is not special. So we can concentrate on the specialness of our collections, which they are, but the question of infrastructure and building these things, I believe, is much better done cooperatively. So from that needs assessment, we have a number of recommendations from our digital program working group and from the work that they did with an IMLS collaborative planning grant over the last year. And these recommendations were just issued a couple of weeks ago. This is very fresh. So we'll be moving forward with digital services this fiscal year, hosting materials for access, moving into digital preservation, providing scanning and reformatting services through institutional cooperative agreements across the area. We have a prototype of a meta-search tool that not only brings together collections from DSpace, Content DM, and the EAD database, but begins to make some inroads to relate EAD content to individual digitized content, which is one of those very difficult problems. And then continuing with training on various aspects of digital projects and programs. As we move forward into the future, we're in our seventh year at this point. Sustainability is on our minds absolutely every day. But the economic pressures that we face right now call for more collaboration, not less. My parent institution, the Orbis Cascade Alliance, is moving toward a number of modes of fairly radical collaboration, shared technical services, a single catalog, looking at shared storage, actually more distributed rather than centralized storage across the region. We can no longer afford to localize what is perhaps better done in cooperation. The challenge in tough economic times is to reach out in collaboration and be willing to do something radical rather than to kind of hunker down and bunker down. That's really quite difficult. All the questions of archival description, mass digitization, the many other things that we're chewing on as a profession naturally tie into all this. And particularly for the academic libraries among our membership, it's the growing importance of the locally held unique collections. That's my big umbrella term for not only archives and special collections, but for other things. That's if we have all the published material widely available, then that makes us turn toward those unique collections. And we talk about that a lot as a profession, but it's an agenda that we need to continue to push. That's where you find me, and that's the end of that. I will turn it over next to Jennifer.
Good morning. I'm Jennifer Betts from the Rhode Island Archival and Manuscript Collections Online Project. We are a very new EAD consortium, so even though I'm on this panel today, I'll be learning from all of you probably as much as you are learning from the panel. As I said, we are a very new consortium. We looked at a lot of the other EAD consortiums and based our plan on theirs. Actually, we looked at Northwest Digital Archives and got a lot of great information from Jody. We have a 2-year grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Brown University was the lead participant in applying for that grant. The reason that Brown took the lead on that was because they were already using EAD, so they had the technological infrastructure, and they wanted to give back to the Rhode Island community. So what Brown did was, in 2006, they had a small symposium at Brown where they brought together members of different repositories from across Rhode Island and introduced them to Brown Archival and Manuscript Collections Online, which is BAMCO. And we showed them what we were doing through BAMCO and talked to them about EAD and how we wanted to bring them aboard. And our vision, Brown's vision, was to have one web interface where researchers could go to locate collections all across Rhode Island. And the reason for that is Rhode Island is very small, so it's not a great hardship to have to drive from one end to the other. But a lot of the collections were very hidden. There are family collections that are spread across Rhode Island that researchers don't know where to go. And even the repositories aren't always sure who has what materials from a certain family or a certain subject area. So our vision was for the researchers to be able to go to this one website and locate all these items across Rhode Island. So in 2007, we applied for the NEH grant, and we did receive that. The way that we have RIAMCO structured is there's an advisory board on which Jody serves. We have an executive committee. All of the members of all of the participants in Rhode Island, there are 10 participating repositories. All of them have a member on the executive committee. And then we have three committees, which basically have do all the work. We have a best practices committee, which did a lot of work last fall to set up our best practices. We have a web design committee, which has obviously created our website and decided what the search interfaces will look like. And we have an outreach committee who helped design the logo. We have a bookmark for outreach purposes. We do have a website right now, I just want to mention that, but we don't have search capabilities yet, so you can go to the website and bookmark it, but come back and visit us later this fall to actually be able to find any finding aids there. Our project basically has three stages. We had preparation and training from July to November of last year. We had the Society of American Archivists sent someone to us last year to provide DAX training describing Archives of Content Standard, which was really fabulous because we didn't always have have the descriptive practices we needed in a single repository, and we certainly didn't all share the same descriptive practices across Rhode Island. So that was really great to get us on the same page. Then another part of our training was we had 2 days of EAD training from Daniel Pitty, which was really fantastic. He did a great job. So that really got everybody up to speed. So Brown wasn't the only one who knew how to use EAD at that point. We got everybody educated. So right now we're still at the second stage, the production and the sustainability. Last fall, people started creating their EADs and submitting them to the submission database where we track everyone's EADs. And this fall, we will be entering the third stage, which is our dissemination. We'll be launching the website, doing beta testing, tweaking the website, and we'll be disseminating the bookmark and sending out emails to let people know where we stand on that. These are the participants, the RIAMCO participants, and as you can see, it's a variety of repositories. We have public, private, we have academic repositories, we have the Historical Society, the State Archives, we have a public library. We really wanted to include a lot of different types of repositories across Rhode Island to build people's confidence and kind of show other repositories in Rhode Island that, yes, you too can do this. All they need to do is, we use NoteTab Pro, so the repositories simply need to purchase NoteTab Pro. We share the templates that we've created to create the EADs and give them a login for the submission database. We provide training, and at that point they can start participating in RIAMCO. As I said, we do have a website, www.riamco.org. So please do visit us, but as I said, we're not active right now, so bookmark us and come back and look at us. I do have bookmarks in the back at the water station, so be sure to grab one of those. And for this session, we also set up a blog, just in case we don't have time for questions at the end, so I will leave that address there. So if we run out of time, please submit a question to the blog, or feel free to contact any of us individually. Thank you.
I'm Christine DiBella, and I'm going to be talking a little bit about the Philadelphia Area Consortium of Special Collections Libraries, or PACSCL. PACSCL is a regional consortium for libraries, archives, and museums in the Philadelphia area. We were founded in 1985, so it's the nation's oldest special collections consortium of its kind. When PACSCL was founded, collaboration in special collections arena was kind of unheard of. It's now, as you hear, becoming a lot more common, especially when it relates to technological initiatives, but we are still an innovator in some important ways. PACSCL's members range from small one-person repositories within larger organizations to large historical societies and universities. The members include huge entities like the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Delaware, the Tri-College Consortium, which is Haverford College, Bryn Mawr College, and Swarthmore College. We also have specialized repositories like the Chemical Heritage Foundation and the College of Physicians. Regional leaders such as the American Philosophical Society and the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, and then also really, really small places like the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society and the Wagner Free Institute of Science. PACSCL itself, in terms of the central core administration of it, is very small. It has a part-time executive director, but no other staff and no physical offices. The executive director actually works out of her home. Most work is completed through either volunteer member labor or specific grant-funded positions that are hired for specific projects that the consortium has sought funding for. These are usually based, when they need a physical base, they're usually based at one of the member repositories. We solicit and get participation from one of the member repositories to host the project. Paid consultants are sometimes employed for other smaller projects, such as revamping the website. When I talk about projects, we've had a real variety of things that have gone on in the consortium. They include a geohistory initiative to do scanning and geotagging of different elements in member collections, a shared online catalog for some of our smallest repositories, as well as a federated search across all of the catalogs of member repositories. We've done a small EAD encoding initiative, though that didn't actually lead to a repository the way Jody's or Jennifer's consortiums have. We've also done things that happen in the physical world, like shared exhibits and publications. And in fact, a shared exhibit and publication was the impetus for the consortium in the first place. We have done some work in technical services, shared NACO work, shared cataloging that happened at different repositories, though in that case, we didn't really have a central standard for how that cataloging was going to be done. Each institution got to decide what they wanted to catalog and how they wanted to catalog it and work at their own pace and work on it until the funding ran out. We're looking at different models for that now because I think that's maybe no longer the way to go. I worked on one of the most recent grant-funded projects in the consortium, specifically the Consortial Survey Initiative, which was an effort to assess unprocessed and underprocessed collections at 22 of the member repositories. Then this shared assessment data, it's now serving as the basis for a much larger initiative, which is shared cataloging, shared processing even of collections, and also going to be leading to the creation of an EAD repository. This is, I think, even though there have been a number of collaborative processing projects at different places, it really is kind of an innovation, certainly for us and maybe even for the profession, in that we're developing central processing standards. We're using centrally trained processing staff, mostly students, sending them out to the different repositories and working on a certain number of collections. So even though the project itself is only going to address a small number of collections, we're hoping that it's going to transform technical services in our members to a degree by really changing the practice. PACSCoL, because it's been around for a while, it's actually experienced some growing pains. One of the things that's happened in the last year is a real reevaluation of the member guidelines and the governance structure. So instead of having a one member, one vote model that it had before, it's now moving to a representative governance structure. So the elected board consists of 9 different members, and that's where most of the decision making happens. The members at large participate in different affinity groups and standards committees and different things like that. But instead of having huge meetings where 33 different institutions are represented and really nothing can get done on a decision-making basis, it's happening in a much smaller group. I'm in a kind of sort of a strange position now from what most of the panelists are in. I'm actually a member of an institution that's considering whether it'd be worth it to us to join PACSCoL. Where I work now, the Institute for Advanced Study, we would be one of the smaller organizations in terms of collection size and staff size. But we do have access to good IT infrastructure, and we also have access to some of the resources of a much larger university, Princeton University, even though we're not part of that university. And though the PACSCoL service area does extend outside of the Philadelphia proper, to include such places as the University of Delaware or Franklin and Marshall College, we would be the first New Jersey institution. And so we would have to think whether it made sense for us to participate in a consortium that's so regionally based. It's not so much the financial cost to us that's a concern. It's really the staffing cost. But we do see some really good intangible benefits that could come to us from participating in a consortium like PACSCoL. One of the reasons we now have an archives at the Institute is we received very generous funding from a private foundation. It's very important to the foundation that the visibility of the archives be raised. And joining a group like PACSCoL, we sort of see as a quick route to gaining that additional visibility, sort of indicate that we have arrived. We're participating with all these other well-known repositories. We also might benefit from participating in some of the specific projects of the consortium. We're a little bit late to the game to participate in the collaborative processing and cataloging initiative, but I could certainly see things that would come down the pike that we would be really interested in. And lastly, this would be sort of more of a benefit to me personally, but right now I work in an organization where I'm the only archivist, and I have wonderful library colleagues, but no one who really is attuned or involved in the archives profession. I certainly found it to be very beneficial to have access, easy, direct access to professional colleagues in a lot of different locally based institutions. One of the things that we're really thinking about at the Institute is would it be worth it enough to participate in a consortium because of that kind of benefit? There are other ways to have access to your professional colleagues. It doesn't necessarily have to happen within a consortium, but it might be one of the easiest, quickest ways to do it, to get access that way. So, turn it back to our panel then.
Okay, thank you everybody for your presentations of what's going on at your consortia. And now we're going to open up the floor to questions. And I think somebody else at a past session yesterday had a really good exhortation that's like, if you're thinking it, somebody else is too, so don't be shy. We've got a microphone right here, so if you just want to step up to the mic, and then we'll get a discussion going.
Sue Hamburger at Penn State. I'm curious, with Northwest Digital Archives, are you finding any financial problems from your consortial members with this economic times where they're not wanting to pay their membership? And is that presenting a problem at all, or is that not an issue?
Sure, it's a problem. It's a problem. Nobody wants to pay membership fees even when the economic times are good. We have one institution in particular that we did a great deal of work with this spring, the Oregon Historical Society, as you all may be familiar with, temporarily closed its research library, laid off all of its staff, and then rehired 3.5 FTE to run the place. We serve as basically the main access to all of their collections. So our challenge for me as a program manager and for my steering team was to go and talk to that institution to remind them of the fact that we provided good access to their collections, that it's quite cost effective, and that their collections are among our most consistently retrieved. Our dedication to metrics and statistics tends to help us in these situations. But yes, it's economic times are particularly tough in Oregon and Washington right now. Not so much in Montana, Idaho, and Alaska are kind of in the middle, but it's on our mind every day.
This is for anybody who wants to answer it. Hopefully, the more the merrier. Taking a step back and looking at the big picture for your consortiums, I was wondering, do you have a couple of do's and or don'ts as far as the basic running of a consortium, keeping it moving forward, not nitpicky things like particular technical aspects, but again, the big picture on how to keep the consortium together and moving forward?
good question.
Well, I'll just mention a few things that I think have... I think Paxful, in some ways, did stagnate a bit. It has been around a long time, a long time in the context of these kinds of consortia. So it's gone through different phases. I think one of the things... Because Paxful was sort of developed with the idea of kind of general interest in collaboration, but not necessarily always with specific projects in mind, I think Paxful has found that there's a lot more energy when there actually is a specific project, rather than just an intangible interest in playing nicely together. So I think we've had to find projects that really engage the interest of the different members. Sometimes you can't find a project that interests every single person, every single institution in the consortium, but you can find ones that engage the interest of quite a few. So I think the current cataloging and processing initiative, that has the participation of 24 different members. There are 33 members in the consortium, so that actually is a very popular one. It has encouraged some of the institutions to actually participate more than they had been in the recent past. So I would say that's a definite do. Find things that work. Something I'd say that is kind of a don't is... Don't get into a project and then start thinking about sustainability. Start thinking about how it's gonna. What are you gonna do when it ends? Given the small infrastructure of Paxful, I think that's always a problem, and sometimes it's perceived as a real weakness when Paxful goes out and seeks funding that we haven't necessarily always followed through to the very end, or we haven't sustained a project. So it's really important to think of that far ahead. Rather than when you're in the midst of it.
To amplify a little bit and to something we were talking about over breakfast this morning, I think one of the challenges and a definite do is a balance between kind of strategic planning, centralized initiative bringing forth, and letting things bubble up from the membership. Letting people follow their interest and really balancing those two things, because going with either one, too much one way or the other, can lead to some imbalance. Over-centralization, you may lose your members' interest, but with not enough centralization, you don't have that long-term strategic direction that, among other things, helps you get funding. The other thing about funding and sustainability, I absolutely agree with Christina that you have to think of sustainability earlier rather than later. And a big part of that is understanding what costs are and making sure that your members understand that. There's money, there's time, there's other factors, and there really isn't any magic way to make those go away. Anything that may appear magical is in fact probably putting it off until later. So it's a real firm business planning sort of business.
For Arizona Archives Online, we found that the most important part to sustain is your central technology. Make sure you have the server and the web space, and that's going to be maintained. We've had partners come and go and contribute different amounts over the years as their staff changed, and that's worked really well for us. Whatever an institution can give, we'll take, as long as we have that central technology to keep supporting them. Yes.
Hi. Okay. I was curious about for those
can
of you,
you
who have
come up to the microphone.
For those of you, who have the more recent partnerships and consortia that you've developed, I was really curious about. What were some of the biggest stumbling blocks and roadblocks when you were first getting started? And how did you overcome those early problems that you might have had?
The communication was probably our earliest stumbling block. Bringing everybody, it helped us to bring everybody together face to face in a room and really find out what all the repositories' needs were, what the status of their finding aids were, really getting that face to face contact and communicating with people. And hopefully that the continued communication will help us with the sustainability. Right now, because we're in the middle of the project, we all meet pretty frequently, which is really great. We do have concerns that a year from now when the project ends or past that, that may be a problem if we're not all coming together face-to-face and communicating. But right now we are doing that. That was probably our biggest stumbling block in the beginning.
For Arizona Archives Online, our biggest stumbling block right now is having members have the workforce to put into actually being full partners and getting their guides encoded into EAD. And our solution for that has been using student labor. We've been training students centrally and then sending them out to various members or having them work centrally and the members send in their guides. So that's one way we can address a specific problem institutions are having and help them get over that stumbling block.
Hi, I'm Joy Palmer, and I'm responsible for the Archives Hub in the UK, which is a consortium of 170 archives now. And you mentioned stats and demonstrating value, and one thing that we're finding we're going to have to start doing more and more is not just being able to talk about stats, but about demonstrating value and demonstrating impact in the research and the user community. I mean, our user community is largely researchers, and that's a very different type of evidence base to access. And I wondered if any of these consortia have thought about that or started doing any kind of work around demonstrating value and impact in terms of the end user communities.
We've done that in a couple of different ways. Our primary way, of course, is to rely first on the anecdotal feedback and evidence from our members. And our members are able to report that naturally if they have a researcher showing up in the reading room with a printed out guide from NWDA in their hand, something worked. If they are able to discern, not formally, we're not doing this qualitatively, how often the requests are coming as a result of participation. Really everybody in our end of grant assessment reported increases in use, some of which they felt they could attribute to NWDA. The other thing as part of our digital program planning that we did was a researcher needs study, which I mentioned very briefly. Now that was about digital content sites, but we included our EAD site in order to assess. One of the basic questions we wanted to know is, well, do our primary research audiences hate the EAD site and love all the digital content sites? What happens if we look at the same collection on the EAD site with links to digital content versus the presentation on Content DM? And we found actually that they didn't like either presentation very well. They want something in between. They like the context and the metadata presented in the finding aid. But the Content DM presentation visually is better for them. So that drives the development of our cross-search prototype where we're trying to marry those things together in a more usable way. So that's what we're doing in that area.
Hi, Barbara Akins, Archives of American Art at the Smithsonian. I have so many questions, but I'll restrict it to one. Most of you mentioned that you got sort of substantial funding to start your consortia groups. I'm wondering how you actually spent that money. What were your initial priorities for funding, given that you all have, I assume, full-time jobs elsewhere? Did you hire project coordinators, or how did you spend the $300,000 plus the $178,000 from the federal funding agencies?
So, basically about startup costs and how that was spent in terms of organizing the...
Right. I mean, obviously you got grants to start the projects with, and then the grant funding goes away, but I'm really curious as to how you spent the initial funding.
Yeah, exactly. As far as RIAMCO, I'm the project manager, and so it pays my salary. And we also have subcontracts with some of our members. So they use their funds to to employ students to encode their finding aids. We have a lot of that. We paid for all our training through the grant. So those were the biggest costs. As far as technological infrastructure, that was all provided by Brown University. So we the grant money didn't go towards that. And then as far as NOTAB Pro, each institution was responsible for purchasing it themselves. So that did not come out of the grant. So the biggest costs that came out of the grant were my salary, the subcontracts that the different repositories have paying to have their finding aids encoded, and the training.
Do you have anything to add?
In PaxCal, I mean, we're long beyond startup, obviously, though specific projects have started up in the more recent times. I will say, though, that every time that we do get a project, the funding essentially just goes to the project itself. Nothing goes to central staffing, central infrastructure. That's really paid through the dues that members pay. So even though we have 33 members, those dues only go so far. So those dues basically pay for the part-time executive director. They pay for occasional mailings. They pay for the website to be hosted, things like that. But it's a recurring, long-running problem that there really isn't any money to go towards those kinds of core functions, that it all goes towards projects themselves.
For NWDA, in our initial phase, it's a little bit hard for me to remember exactly how the money was split out, but we had subcontracts with the 13 participating institutions for actually encoding for additional staff and things like software. We did a vendor contract for outsourcing encoding. There were meetings and travel costs. Remember this, the geographical distances that we're dealing with are up to 1,800 miles between institutions. So having travel funding was very important. Our technical infrastructure in the first phase was mostly an in-kind contribution from Washington State University, which houses our technical infrastructure. But then we bought all the equipment, the software, all of those kinds of things. In the second phase, we found, after our experiences in the first phase, where we had done all of our administration out of Hyde on cost share, there was a 0.25 project administrator at the home institution doing it on top of her regular job, naturally doing a fabulous job, but finding that was not sustainable. They hired me in the second phase at 0.4 FTE of what was now a 23-institution consortium, finding that having dedicated project staff, once you get past a certain size particularly, is very important. And now my job has gone all the way to halftime, which is great. And as a telecommuter from Missoula, Montana, that has a University of Oregon email address, that works just fine. You can actually be an archivist at a distance of a certain type. So I would also say that of our approximately $100,000 yearly budget, two-thirds of that goes to running the EAD program, and about a third of it has gone to this digital program planning process, which is not separate. It's closely tied to the EAD program, but that's more, you know, kind of pushing our next agenda. And our yearly budgets are available online through our member website. Any of you can look at them, and you're quite welcome to see them.
I'm Noah Leinster from the University of Illinois, and I had another. Oh, is this on? I'm Noah Leinster from the University of Illinois, and I had another question about startup. And my question is about extant archival regional associations that are out there. There's many regional and sub-regional and urban archive associations across the country, and I was wondering if you had any advice about how, perhaps based on your own experiences, you tap into extant archival networks. Or networks of archivists and developing regional consortia. In other words, I'm thinking about OCLC's report on the collaboration continuum. I see as a valuable tool not only for collaborations among libraries, archives, and museums, but more generally a valuable tool in thinking about going from contact to convergence and developing infrastructure that can really support collaboration. And I wonder if you have any thoughts about how you move along from contact among archivists or special collections curators to the development of infrastructure.
So your question is about looking at extant groups,
yeah.
regional or for a specific purpose like
yeah.
catalogs.
Yeah, how you tap into what's already there.
Uh-huh.
Northwest Digital Archives has drawn on the resources of two extant groups. We would not exist if it was not for the Northwest Archivists. The group got started, well, there's debate about this, of course, either at a Northwest Archivist meeting in Bellingham in 2000 or at an online Northwest meeting in 2001. We debate this. I wasn't at the online Northwest meeting, so of course I don't think it started there. And we didn't draw on that administrative structure so much as the fact that we were at a meeting. Chris and Michael had come and done the EAD training, and we all got inspired and excited. Now that we're part of the Orbis Cascade Alliance, of course, that was drawing on the existence of a present institution and adopting their administrative structure. I didn't actually talk about our administrative structure very much, but we do, like others, have a committee of the whole with an institutional representative from each one. This is exactly how we do all the committees within the Orbis Cascade Alliance. We have working groups. We have an executive committee that conducts most of the business. So I would say in both cases, we've drawn very heavily on existing organizations, and that has that's been very beneficial, the process of truly starting from scratch administratively and bringing people together is time-consuming, money-consuming. And so whenever we can draw on those existing structures, I think it's quite beneficial.
Hi, I'm Joel Wuerl from NEH. I'm mostly just standing here to make sure Jody and Jennifer were answering the question about funding, honestly. You did nicely. But what I really wanted to do was to speak to the virtues of collaboration. I think all of you, in talking about your startup, clearly pointed out the impact that the work that you're doing has on the success of obtaining funding from major agencies. I guess that's no secret, but this is great testimony to that. Federal agencies and other funding agencies are very interested in collaboration. Of course, there's no magic or silver bullet for obtaining the kind of funds that institutions need, but we very much are interested in the types of projects such as these that have impact beyond a single institution and that really do involve true collaboration and enable several institutions to come together and achieve economies of scale. So, you know, you could add CLEAR to the mix, of course, too, in terms of the hidden collections funding that was important for the Paxville initiative. But I wanted to thank you for mentioning the NEH support that you've received. So.
Actually, I had a question that was sparked by a couple of questions from the audience, but also Jennifer's comment on training and how some of the funding was used initially for training your member institution staff in basically modern standards for processing and that kind of thing. And what impact do you think that had on bringing people on board, not just in terms of like technology and standards, but also like just sort of mentally and culturally?
As far as, especially the DAX training, I think it made a great deal of difference because most of the people that took advantage of that training were from smaller repositories where they probably wouldn't have sought out the SAA training for funding reasons, just getting there and paying for the registration. So it was great that we were able to offer it in Rhode Island and that it was so easy for them to attend. They felt like they were kind of being brought up to the same level that that Brown had already achieved. So that made a great deal of difference. As far as the EAD training, I think that helped build people's confidence in their technical skills. I think a lot of people wanted to use EAD, but there was kind of this big divide there, people not wanting to take the plunge, not really feeling ready for it, not having the support in their home repository. So I think coming into a consortium where everybody was in the same boat, they could ask each other questions, it just was a source of comfort, I think, to have that training for everybody.
Kind of dispelling the fear of the unknown. Right, exactly. And I think we have time for one more question. So.
Rebecca Johnson, Melvin University of Delaware Library, and this is sort of a testimony to the benefit of participating in the consortium. And I was going to comment before that question came up, the benefit to all of us to advancing the archival description standards. And PACSCoL, we're seeing not only like the EAD, which we're not necessarily intimidated by it outside, but didn't have the infrastructure or the power of demonstrating it to systems in a library environment or something. And I think it's really helping us with EAD. And we also see the potential of EAC and name authority and doing more with NACO or some other parallel type, in context information. So I think it's going to help us all. And hopefully these consortiums that are regional will somehow merge and become the bigger national thing that we've been looking for. And it's great to see UK Hub here. And you guys do great publicity. Every time you say something, I go look at it. You do really nice outreach, and so we can demonstrate, look how well this works. So thanks for being here.
Thanks, Rebecca. That's a great comment. And I think that emphasizes something I don't know if we brought out enough during our presentations, is that these things build on each other. So like maybe you start with EAD, but then when you grow, you realize there's something else you can do and you can move on and sustain through finding the next challenge to tackle. And with that, I'd like to thank our panelists once again and thank you all for your comments and questions.